I was asked to talk to you on the topic that I spoke to the 11th and 12th graders about today. So I would have liked to speak to the 9th and 10th graders about also, because their questions began gravitating in that direction, actually. That's the whole topic of dating and relationships, which is the biggest topic on many girls' minds and guys' minds at this age. It's a little bit of a preoccupation sometimes even, whether it's about present issues or future ones. So I want to basically kind of tell you what I said to them so that maybe those of you who have daughters in EULA could be on the same page, or others of you, hopefully it'll be helpful information to you.
Well, most of these people have daughters at other schools.
Beatrice Yaakov mother's here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So maybe, actually, I'm going to change a little bit then, because I'd like what I say to be relevant to everybody. Thank you for telling me that. Because some of what I said to the girls at EULA might not be as necessary for a Beis Yaakov girl to hear. So I'm going to try and figure out, because it's like different, they have different questions. No, there's different areas, different things are accepted as givens, and other things are not, in different places and whatever. So I'm going to try and, I'll maybe talk a little bit about a couple different things. All right, so I'll throw in what I talked about to the 9th and 10th graders also, okay? And maybe I'll even start with that. One of the biggest issues that I think that girls are struggling with this day, and I don't think it's only in the secular world by any means, is the whole question of self-definition and defining themselves in a deeper way than society is basically defining girls today. The typical Jewish institution that deals with questions of self-definition is one that has become so unpopular that I didn't even use the word for it until towards the very, very end of my talk to the 9th and 10th graders at EULA today, and that is sneas. When I don't use the word, it's either because the audience is not religious and it sounds too religious to use this word, or because the audience is so religious that they're sick of hearing about it. Okay, but the fact is that sneas, if it's understood properly, is probably the most valuable tool that there is for assuring that your daughter grows up with a healthy self-image and gets into a healthy relationship based upon real ingredients that can make for something that can last. So the way I explain sneas to our daughters is that we are not talking about a dress code. We're talking about a consciousness that then will naturally manifest itself in the way you present yourself. But the focus is on the consciousness, not on the length of your skirt. Okay? And the consciousness of sneud is the consciousness that of all the layers that define me, I want to, in a sense, kind of peel them away and get to the innermost core of who I am and define myself by that core. And then once I know that that's my essential self, I'll naturally want to present myself in a way that reflects that to other people. And there's a lot of ways, a lot of metaphors and angles I could come in on to describe what I mean by knowing who you are deep down. And perhaps the best way is just to cut right to a story of an amazing woman that I know of who unfortunately was nifter about a year ago, died about a year ago, who when I heard about this woman, I thought to myself, wow, this is a woman who really knows who she is. Like, if we were all as clear as this person is, I just think the basis for relationships in this world and sense of self would be so much healthier and solid. So I'm just going to tell you this story, because I don't think anything can say it better than this story can. I really don't. Okay, some of you may have heard of this woman, and the woman who authored a book about her recently, named Sarah Rigler. Did any of you hear Sarah Rigler speak here in L.A.? So she wrote the book Holy Woman. Okay, I don't know how much she told you about Reverend Chaya Sarah Kramer, but I'm going to tell you something about her that struck me very strongly when I heard about this from Sarah years ago before she had written her book. Reverend Chaya Sarah Kramer, to me, personifies internal self-definition. When she was 20 years old, she and her family were deported, her whole extended family were deported to Auschwitz. Her entire family were sent to the left by Dr. Mengele, and basically went up in smoke that evening. She was sent to the right, and along with one sister. The sister was later shot in front of her eyes, and she was reserved for medical experimentation at the hands of Dr. Mengele. She was experimented on. She survived the operation. She survived Auschwitz. went to Palestine, met and married her husband with one thought in mind, which is to have more children to name after her deceased aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents and sisters and brothers. Okay, she found out that she could not have children with her husband. And so what happened is over the years, she ended up fostering and adopting an incredible number of deformed and physically and mentally challenged children whose parents basically, unfortunately, were rather happy to give them up. She took in over 30 of them in the course of her lifetime in a house that was about the size of this room, a little two-room hut in a moshav with no paved floor, nothing. They lived in abysmal poverty. These kids were incontinent. She had to do a phenomenal amount of laundry every day without a washing machine. Okay, no, never mind disposable diapers, forget about that. Without a washing machine, without hot running water, and basically a pot of water on a kerosene burner. Okay, so that's her life in a nutshell. A woman who survived Auschwitz, survived childlessness, and then went on to raise over 30 kids who couldn't even express appreciation for all the incredible physical labor that she put into their rearing. Okay? When my friend Sarah Rigler went out to meet this woman, she heard she was a holy woman and very quickly found out what made her holy. But she had a deeper question. What gave her the strength to accomplish everything she's accomplished and come through with a smile on her face? So many people lost their minds because of what they suffered in the Holocaust. In my neighborhood of Har Nof, at the top of the hill, there's a mental hospital called Kfar Sha'ul. And this hospital 20 years ago was populated entirely by Holocaust survivors. Okay? What gave her the strength to come through all this suffering with a smile? So in the course of the conversation, Sarah asked her, what was it like in Auschwitz? And Revison Kramer said something that was very difficult to understand. And if any of you have grandparents or parents who went to the camps, you might find the statement offensive. Please don't be offended by it. She said it just to make a point. Okay, not to be taken literally. She said Auschwitz was not a bad place. So Sarah said, how can you, of all people, possibly say that? And in Revison Kramer's answer to that question, I think, is encapsulated in the most simplistic, you know, some of those beautiful truths are just so simple. The most simple, beautiful way is encapsulated this whole concept of internal definition that is the consciousness of tzniut. Okay? Revison Kramer said, I was in Auschwitz with a group of other young religious women from Hungary, and together we tried to observe all the mitzvot that we could. When Hanukkah came, someone found wax, melted it down, made candles, lit them. When Pesach came, somebody recited off the Haggadah by heart. She had memorized it. So we could repeat it after her and have some semblance of a Pesach Seder. We did chesed for one another. We kept each other going when we were ill. We fed each other our last morsels of bread and water. We did as many mitzvahs as we could in Auschwitz. And then she looked my friend Sarah straight in the face and she said to her, you, who come from that beautiful place in America where you had everything you wanted, food, clothing, makeup, a roof over your head, a lawn, a car, you know, you name it, you had it. And your life was so comfortable and easy, so good. But there were so many Jews there like you who didn't know enough about Torah to keep a single mitzvah. That was a bad place. For me, Auschwitz was a good place. This woman to me represents the epitome of tzniut. I didn't even know what she looked like or dressed like until I saw photographs of her in Sarah's recently released book. This is a woman who is so spiritually self-defined that she knows that she's not a body, she's a soul. And so therefore the quality of her life has to be defined not by how good it is for her body, but how much her soul can express itself. Maybe else has a cell phone. Maybe now's a good time to turn off. Oh, I didn't realize. Okay. Maybe put it on vibrate or something. Okay. So this is a woman who basically felt that a good place is defined not by how comfortable it is, but how much my soul can express itself there. Because I'm a soul. And if my soul can express itself better in Auschwitz by doing more mitzvot there, then Auschwitz is a better place for me to be than some environment in which my soul cannot express itself. Okay? This is the most concise definition, I think, I've ever heard of tzniut, of defining yourself as a soul and defining yourself internally. The message that I try and get across to girls is that they have to try and imbue themselves with this consciousness and then let it affect how they dress and how they interact with people. That a girl who knows who she is, deep down, will not need to get attention by being the most provocative girl on the street. And in fact, she won't want to get attention for that. She'll want somebody's attention to be drawn, you know, certainly to appreciate her appearance, because that's the world we live in and that's the way guys work, but somebody who will appreciate not only her appearance, but will be drawn into appreciating who she is as a person and relate to her on that level and find in her a far more compelling kind of beauty. Okay? That's basically how I describe tzniut to them. And I carry this concept forward into relationships. What the idea that I'm trying to get girls to realize is that tzniut is the foundation of any healthy relationship. That your love and appreciation can be as deep for one another as you know who one another is and as you know how deep your own self is. And what girls seem to be mostly afraid of today is that there's a lot of competition out there. And if they don't play the game, they're going to lose. A girl just said, a grown woman actually, you know, in her 20s, just 30s maybe even, just said to me, the previous engagement I was at tonight, you know, but like, what do you do when you're at a party and everybody else is looking really, really attractive and provocative? And you know, what, you're going to be the girl sitting in the corner, like in the high button shirt? You know what I mean? Okay. So what I try to do, and I never know if I'm completely successful because it's a very hard issue, what I try and do is try and empower women to realize that the right person will appreciate them for who they are, and they might even be more noticed by a quality guy by radiating quality. And so I tell them a couple stories to illustrate this. One of them, which I think is a really, really cute story, is of a friend of mine who was working in a restaurant at the same time that she was becoming religious.
Okay.
Okay. So the friend of mine was becoming religious while she was working in this restaurant. So first she decides to become Shomer Negiyah, and she kind of, and I don't know how she did it, but she let it be known to all the male waiters and other people, men who worked there, that, you know, they shouldn't touch her anymore, and no more with the arms or on the shoulder and the slapping five and the kissing on the cheek and all that kind of stuff and all the flirtatious stuff that goes on. So the guys basically are being told they can't touch this girl, which is a very weird thing in our society. So they kind of begin distancing themselves from her socially a little bit, you know, she's a little bit weird. Then she starts coming in long skirts with long sleeves and high necklines, and now they think she's really cracked. And everyone basically kind of is treating her very cordially from a distance. Well, of course, they're increasingly social with all the other women in the restaurant. Okay? So it began to feel rather uncomfortable for her being in this environment, as you might imagine. So she left that job. A few weeks later, one of the waitresses called her up and said to her in the course of their conversation, you know, there's something you don't understand. You saw how all the other men, all the men in the restaurant there were very, very social with all of us women, you know, who are all dressed like, you know, whatever, okay, and acting, you know. We're all very social with all of us, and you they basically ignored. After you left, no fewer than 7 guys came over to me, one after the other, and said to me that she's the kind of girl we want to marry. This is a completely true story. I saw this woman after many years by chance in Silver Spring 3 months ago. And I just rechecked out the story with her to make sure I've been telling it right all these years. Okay, I have been. Okay? I want to empower girls to feel that they don't have to lower themselves to meet these horrible expectations that they think that men have of them, and that rather, they should realize that within every guy lies a beautiful soul, and maybe it can be brought out if they expect higher of men. If you expect a man to look at you as a person and you dress and behave accordingly, and the man ends up relating to you on a deeper level, a guy can discover within himself how much he really wants the real thing, since guys tend to be led very easily in other directions, if you know what I mean. I tell girls that my definition of a guy lately is that a guy is a soul, but he's a very easily distracted soul. Okay, guys are not animals or dogs or pigs. They are easily distracted souls. Okay, and it's your choice. If you want to be one of the distractions and pull them off in that direction where they're following their lower desires, you can do that. And if you want to believe in yourself enough to believe that a quality guy will recognize quality within you, and if he gives all his attention at the party to the girls dressed in the lower cut shirt, then maybe he's just not the guy for you at this time in his life. Okay? If he's not, doesn't want to give you a chance. Okay? So this is in essence, in a very brief nutshell, the essence of the idea that I try and get across to women. And I try and impress upon them the fact that how they present themselves to other people, regardless of where they are, is what's going to shape their own self-image. Because the way other people look at us gets reflected back into how we see ourselves. So even if a girl says to me, I know I'm really spiritual, so therefore it doesn't matter what I wear, because I know who I am, I try and tell her it's not the way the world works, that we become the person that we see other people seeing us as. Sociologist once said, I am who I think you think I am. I become the person that I think other people perceive me as. So if a girl walks down the street, no matter how much she knows she's a beautiful soul, okay, attracting a lot of attention to her body, her self-image is going to basically spiral downwards. It's going to become eroded. And a girl testified to me that just about 5 hours ago, or whatever it was, at EULA today. This girl came up to me after class, one of the 9th or 10th graders, and she said to me, you know, I used to have really bad acne. And she said, I felt like when I had bad acne, I knew who I was so much better than I do now. This is what she said to me, exactly. She said, I felt like I really saw myself, I appreciated myself, because I couldn't be superficial, because I didn't look good. She said, now my acne's cleared up, and she's a very pretty girl. She said, now I feel like I'm losing that sense of who I am, because I see how easy I can get attention from a guy. And that's who I'm becoming. This is what she said to me. Okay? So I encourage girls to hold on to that deeper self-image and not to play into this kind of downward spiral about getting attention and having an eroded self-image and then getting more attention and going down like that. I want girls to go up in terms of self-respect. Okay? That was a thumbnail sketch of what I tried to say to the 9th and 10th graders today. With the 11th and 12th graders, I talked to, at EULA, this was those mothers who were teaching EULA, I talked about dating and relationships. And there's three basic points that I tried to make, which I think are important to reiterate to all of our girls, maybe even Base Yaakov girls, because I'm sorry, but I've heard lots of stories about girls who go to Base Yaakov. Everything, life is not simple today. Life is just not simple. And the three points I tried to make were basically this. First of all, that people mistakenly think that a decent amount of dating, even perhaps before you're marriage-minded, is kind of necessary for a well-balanced personality. That you have to go out there and get a certain amount of experience so you can understand things, understand men, yourself, etc., so that you can make an intelligent, informed decision about who to marry when the right time comes. Okay? I wanted to destroy this idea because I think it's patently false. This idea that somehow, if I have more dating experience, and even our girls who are groomed for shidduchim, you know, can fall into this. Even if they're not ready for marriage, the idea of just dating now, just to kind of, like, for whatever, okay? That this idea that this experience is somehow going to increase your chances of having a successful relationship is just not right. That the divorce rate in our world has been going up and up parallel to the amount of premarital dating experience people have been having, in case you haven't noticed. I told you about 11-year-olds, 6th graders are doing up birthday parties in Minneapolis. Like, I go all over America and I hear these things that my parents didn't know what they were. You know what I'm saying? These kids are doing in 6th grade birthday parties, you know, and kids are getting married later and later. They have a good 10 to 15 years of dating experience behind them. And the divorce rate is going up and up. The point that I try and stress to girls is that dating experience has practically nothing to do, in my opinion, with marital success. But what makes for a good marriage, ultimately, is the degree to which you work on yourself and you become a more mature, self-understanding person, a more developed individual. And therefore, the best use of your premarital years is to focus on becoming a better sister, a better roommate, a better human being, a better student, a better everything in the context of all your human relationships. So you really have something to offer to some guy when you're ready to look for the real thing. That there's one very crucial question that people forget to ask themselves at this time of their life when they get very preoccupied by the opposite sex, or even if they're only thinking about marriage and they really want to date only for marriage, they're still very preoccupied with, who do I want? What do I want? What's it going to be? What's going to, you know what I mean? I say, you know, fine, get that picture of who you want, this wonderful guy that you want to marry. Now ask yourself the most important question that you could ask yourself. What kind of a girl would he want to marry? And you have to become that girl. If we put a tenth of as much time into becoming a wonderful girl as we put into looking for a wonderful guy, you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The point that I try and make to these girls is that a successful marriage has far more to do not with finding the right person, but with being the right person. So I encourage girls to really step back, take a look at themselves. In my book, it's for sale afterwards if you're interested, Head to Heart, I have a list in one of the chapters, because a girl asked, how do I know when I'm ready to get married? I said, read this chapter. There's a list of 28 questions I put in there. You can ask yourself, or ask a friend to answer for you. Am I this? Am I that? Am I, you know, whatever. I'll give you a little bit of an idea of what's helpful to have in order to have a successful relationship. And if it turns out that you're not there, you don't score so well on this little test here, you know what I mean? Then maybe it just means, thank God, pat yourself on the back for being honest, being willing to look at yourself and willing to grow, and start working on yourself. But first become someone you have who has something to give, then look for someone to give it to. Spend these years productively. Okay? And then when you're ready to date, date for the real thing, because you're ready for the real thing. You're mature enough to handle it. So many kids are getting married today because they reach this magical number. In Israel, it seems to be getting lower and lower all the time. It's getting a little bit frightening. You know, it was 20, it's 19, it's 18. My 13-year-old daughter wants to get married tomorrow. She really does. She's like seriously upset about the fact that in Israel they don't want you to get married until you're 16. You know what I mean? Not seriously upset, I'm exaggerating. But she, you know, okay? And she's like, as soon as I'm 18, boy, you know, okay? We'll talk about it as she grows, you know? I'm not worried. I'm not going to worry about it right now. But the fact is that it's not got to do with a number. It's got to do with who you are and where you're at. You don't just wake up one day and say, well, I'm 18, 19, 20, guess I'm ready to get married. I've reached that magical number. Okay? This is the main point that I try and make to girls about dating. Secondly, I really try and urge them to really be consistent with a religious approach to how to find the right person. When your girl goes to seminary for a year, they might happen to meet a guy somewhere, and then they go to Stern College or whatever college campus they go to. Introductions tend to end up getting a little bit random. You know what I'm saying? It's not like you're in a seminary in Israel where you have some rebbetzin, and if you're staying for a second year, she'll make sure she introduces you to guys who are appropriate for you. Girls start tending to meet guys through friends or at a pizza shop, or someone notices someone somewhere, and like with very little background research and very little description of each of them, people with very good intentions can set people up on a very flimsy basis. You know what I mean? Like actually a friend of mine, a religious friend of mine, was at some Sheva Brachas, like in New York, and some guy noticed her and was interested in her, and the hostess came over to her and said, so-and-so is interested in you, can I set you up? She's like, hello, do you know me? You know? Do you know anything about me? Like, on what basis? Like, find out a little bit about me, find out a little bit about him, and then tell me if you think this is worth it. You know what I mean? But this kind of stuff happens on a regular basis, and girls end up getting involved with guys emotionally who might not be appropriate for them in one way or another. So I encourage girls to be really strict about this. Lead with your head. Lead with your head when you're getting into a relationship, which means make sure that you only date somebody that someone who knows each of you well enough can say that this guy is appropriate for you. This looks good on paper. This is traditional Jewish dating. Stick with it. Okay? That's a pretty simple and straightforward thing. But by using some third party, you can avoid these emotional involvements where the girls get themselves into things. I know one recently, I was just told of one this evening. There's somebody whose brother is in Israel. He's 26 years old. He's been dating a 27-year-old girl for the past, don't ask me how this happened, for the past 4 years. Okay, apparently it's a religious relationship. They're not physically involved. And what's holding up the works? This guy is not sure he wants to get married. Now, why in the world did a girl go out with a guy before knowing that he wanted to get married? She was 23 when she first went out with him. She's 27 now. She can't afford to like fool around too much longer. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is just stupid. You know? But she got emotionally involved with this guy. She really liked him. She didn't check out the most essential thing of all. Is he marriage-minded? You know what I mean? And 4 years later, she's still hanging out with this guy, hoping that he's going to come around. This just blew me away. I couldn't believe this one. Okay? This is not a common, this is a little exaggerated story, but it's a true story nonetheless. Okay? But don't risk emotional involvement with someone who's inappropriate for you. Lead with your head, not your heart. Okay, finally, and I don't know if this is applicable to Beis Yaakov girls, but again, I've been hearing all kinds of interesting stories coming out of Beis Yaakov also. They might not be the norm, but they happen. I feel that any girl who's exposed to the larger world today, unless she's very, very sheltered, needs chizuk in being shomer negiya. Even if they wouldn't dream of getting physically involved with a guy, it empowers them and helps them and makes them feel so much more self-confident about their choice to be shomer negiya if they have good practical reasons for why it's work, and they're not just this kind of like, you know, nerdy, you know, frummy little girl who doesn't want to touch a boy, but they're smart and they're savvy and they understand why it benefits them. So again, it's your discretion. If your daughter needs this, if it would benefit her, if it would be detrimental because she's so sheltered, you don't want to open her eyes to a world that she doesn't have to know about, this is your choice. I play it differently with each of my own kids. Some of my kids, I've given my book, The Magic Touch, to read, and some of them I wouldn't dream of giving it to them, although they might pick it up and read it on their own if they're curious, which probably means that they need it. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? But I have one completely naive kid who barely knows the girl exists at age 17, and I have another kid at 11 who is already curious about everything. Okay? So it depends upon the child. I think more and more kids today, in America for sure, okay, can benefit by hearing why it makes sense to be shomer negiya. Okay? And there's three things that I basically emphasize with the kids. The first one is that people have a very deep need to feel connected and close to somebody of the opposite sex. That kicks in around puberty and it begins to grow until, God willing, people get married. And the problem is that there's a very big difference between being close to someone and merely feeling close. And we crave being close, and very easily feeling close gets confused for being close. If you want to just feel close to somebody, the quickest and easiest and most pleasurable way to accomplish that is just by getting physically involved. Okay? Physical involvement, any physical connection on any level, even holding hands between a guy and a girl, causes them to feel bonded. And there's a chemical basis for this that I read about recently in a book called The Female Brain by a woman named Luann Brizendine, I think. You might be interested in this if you're a doctor. I'm sure you know this. But there's this wonder hormone out there called oxytocin. Okay? Oxytocin is a hormone that a woman secretes when she nurses her baby. It makes her feel bonded to her baby. She also secretes it when she's with a husband or a man, which makes her feel bonded to him as well. And I already knew this. What I learned from this book, what I thought was very interesting, was that a certain amount of oxytocin is secreted even when people touch. When people hug for a mere 20 seconds, you get a positive oxytocin rush. Okay? And what the author in this book said, which I found fascinating, was that oxytocin doesn't just make you feel bonded to a person, but in the process of feeling bonded to them, it also actually, how this happens chemically, it's fascinating to me how feelings can be so chemical. It makes you drop judgment against them and be more likely to trust them. So much so that Ms. Brizendine states explicitly in her book, don't hug a man you don't want to trust. Okay? This is what girls are doing all the time. Okay? that they're getting physically involved with a guy, even on the level of just holding hands, or whatever it's tame, they all have their red lines. You know, the red line might shift with time, which is a very bad sign. They all have this red line that they're not going to cross, but whatever it is, if there's any physical contact, there's something emotional happening as well, which is causing the girl to feel bonded to this person, even though he could be objectively inappropriate for her in any number of ways. So the thing that I point out to girls is that when you get physically involved with a guy, and again, this is just chizuk, just strengthening for girls who wouldn't dream of getting physically involved with a guy, just to help them understand how smart they are and how lucky they are that they do this, okay? But when a girl gets physical with a guy, her objectivity goes out the window. And I tell them the story that happened to me a few years ago of a guy, actually, it wasn't even a woman, because all this stuff is much stronger for women than it is for men. But a guy came to me, and looking very depressed, and said to me, "I feel like I've married the wrong woman." So I said, "Why do you feel that way?" And he said, "I wanted to marry somebody who was into spiritual growth. My wife just sits home all day reading People magazine." So I said to him, "How do you account for the fact that you thought this woman was a spiritual grower, and it seems like she's not?" And he said to me, "When we were dating, we were becoming more religious. We theoretically subscribed to the idea of being Shomer Negiya, but after a couple of weeks, we blew it." And he said, and I quote, "When I asked my wife to marry me, I don't think I had all my wits about me." And that's what this guy said to me. Okay, that he basically realized that he had been blinded to some degree by feeling so close to her because of the physical contact that they had between the two of them. Okay, physical contact causes you to see what you want to see and not to see what you don't want to see in many cases. And the problem is that after you get married, you see everything. And an awful lot of people are in for a very rude awakening, you know, after Sheva Brachas. Okay? So I encourage girls to recognize that in the face of the most important decision you're ever going to make in your life, it might be worth foregoing some present pleasure for the sake of maintaining clarity and choosing wisely. Okay? Benjamin Franklin once said, "Before you're married, keep both eyes wide open. After marriage, keep one eye shut." Which I think is excellent advice. Subjectivity has a place in this world. After marriage. That's when you can be blinded by how wonderful the person is. Not when you're still in the deciding phase. The second point that I make to them has got to do with what love is. I think it's a really, really important point. So much so that I say, if you remember one thing from what I say today, please remember this. The word love is thrown around so indiscriminately today. I think it's kind of being emptied of a lot of its meaning. It's become a quite abused word. And I want girls to feel that they know what it is, and that when they say, "I love you," they know that it's real love. And when someone says, "I love you," to them, that they can also trust in that. So I describe to them, in the words of a rabbi of mine, the difference between false love and genuine love. And I'm sure you've heard this before, but this rabbi was speaking to a bunch of students, and he said to them, "I love chicken." You've heard this before? "My wife's chicken is absolutely incredible. Can't wait to eat it. Love chicken." "But does that mean that I love the chicken?" he said. "No, if I love the chicken, I wouldn't eat it for dinner. You know, I'd build it a house in the backyard, crochet its scarves for the winter, sing it lullabies at bedtime, you know what I mean? That's called loving the chicken." So what am I saying when I say I love chicken? I'm saying I love the way I feel when I eat chicken. Chicken gives me pleasure. Okay? Which basically means, who's the focus on? Who am I in love with? Myself. Then he turned to a girl sitting in the front row and said to her, "Now tell me something. When a boy says to you, 'I love you,' which kind of love does he mean?" And that's a really good question. Because I'm willing to bet you that 90% of people today, when they say "I love you" to somebody, are saying "I love you" out of a very healthy mix of maybe actually liking something they see in the other person and really loving the way that person makes them feel. "You give me so much pleasure," As this one actor said, I think it was the actor who was going out with Bridget Nielsen or whatever, the woman who used to be married to Sylvester Stallone. I'm in love with love. I remember thinking, how would I feel if a guy said to me, I'm in love with love? I think I'd be insulted. What do you mean you're in love with love? I want you to be in love with me. What's this in love with love? You're in love with a feeling. You're not in love with a person. You know what I'm saying? So to give girls an example of what I think true love is, I use the example of Christopher Reeve's wife. After his accident, this guy is, you all know the story, right? This guy is all paralyzed now from the neck down. He tells his wife, this is no life for you, you're going to have to wait on me, you're going to have to do everything for me, I'll be able to give you no pleasure in return. I can't do anything to make you feel good. I can't even hold your hand. You know, please divorce me and marry someone you can have a normal relationship with. And she said to him, never. That's true love. True love is when you can just look at a person irrespective of him being able to give you pleasure and make you feel good, which happens to be a rather important part of marriage, but it's not the essence of love, okay? Being able to look at him and just say, what a beautiful person. I love him for who he is. And anything that's less than this cannot be guaranteed to last, because pleasurable feelings come and go. But what provides the foundation of a relationship, that solid, rock-bottom, you know, foundation, is feeling that no matter how you're feeling towards a person, whether or not he's making you feel good at this moment, whether or not your marriage feels good at this moment, that you can still see those beautiful qualities that cause you to choose to marry him. You can still see all that goodness and the beauty in that person, that you can still love that person for who he is. And if you're married and your marriage isn't feeling so good at that moment, that should inspire you to want to get those good feelings back into your marriage, because you still love the person. Your love doesn't dissipate with the good feelings. Do you know what I'm saying? Because I think anybody who's in marriage can attest to the fact that marriage can go through periods, hopefully brief periods, in which it doesn't feel so good. You know, you're not connecting as well, you're not communicating as well, you haven't spent enough time together, you feel a little distant, whatever it is. It doesn't have to feel good at every moment. What keeps it going is looking at him and saying, I still love him for who he is. I still love him for who he is. Now let's get the good feelings back. You see what I'm saying? So girls have to really know that this is what love is. And if you're dating a guy, you should be able to ask him, you know, when things are getting more serious, what do you see in me that you are seeing me? My husband once asked me this, exactly the way he put it. What do you see in me that you're seeing me? You know? And the guy should be, when you ask the guy this, he should be able to tell you real qualities of character that he sees in you that makes him appreciate you. If he says you're so much fun to be with and you have such a great sense of humor and you're so cute, you know? Okay? But if he says to you, you're such a kind, giving person, you put yourself out so much for other people, you're willing to put other people's needs ahead of your own. You know what I mean? You're caring. You're sensitive. If you say things like that, that's seeing goodness in a person. That's seeing character. And that's the kind of, those are the kind of ingredients that can make for real love. For loving somebody for who they are. Not because they're cute and fun to be with. You know what I mean? Okay? So I try and impress upon girls the fact that maybe if they don't get physically involved, that maybe if they don't get physically involved, it might be easier to discern if the feelings that are developing here are based upon appreciation of who the other person really is, as opposed to loving how much you make me feel. Do you see what I'm saying? That refraining from physical involvement creates a space that allows something more genuine and spiritual to develop. Which does not preclude physical attraction, just means not acting on it. Okay? And the third point that I want to make, that I make with girls, and I didn't make today because I just didn't really have time, but I think it's a very important point. And I found this point to be so powerful with girls. This point alone has helped girls stay Shomer Nagiya. Okay? Is the fact of not wanting to have a past, quote unquote. Okay? That everything you do in your life becomes part of you. It enters into your memory bank. And it can intrude on your later life. Okay? And when I'm speaking to less, you know, right-wing girls, like the non-based Yaakov crowd, and I feel that I can be more blunt and more upfront about things, which I definitely can't be in certain based Yaakov schools, I will actually quote them a Gemara. A very blunt Gemara that says that when a divorced man and a divorced woman marry each other, so it's a second wedding for each of them, there are four people in the marital bed. Okay, you will understand what this means, I assume. The girl sometimes has to explain it to them. Okay? So, thank God, most girls I speak to, I think, have not reached that point, although some have. So I bring it down and make it more relevant to them. I say, look, someday you're going to get married, you're going to have a beautiful wedding ceremony, and it's so symbolic and everything, but the most romantic moment, at least it's the way it's done in like Ashkenazi weddings in Jerusalem, is that, you know, the ceremony's over, the glass is broken, and the bride and groom look at each other and take hands, presumably for the first time, and are escorted by people singing and dancing to the yichud room. They go in there, lock the door behind themselves, and they can express their affection for one another physically, right? Presumably for the first time. I say to them, you know, there's a lot of people who have to ask themselves a very sad, sad question today. And that question is, when I go into that yichud room, how many other people do I want to be in there with us? This alone has kept girls from being Shomer Negiah. I'm serious. A girl told me in Israel that when I said this, that clinched her decision for her. My 13-year-old girl, who is a little bit savvy and a little bit precocious, and is already thinking along these lines of Shomer Negiah and not Shomer Negiah, you know, this kind of, believe it or not, a little bit Yaakov girl in Jerusalem, these thoughts still enter their heads. You know, when she this also clinched it for her. You know, she was able to be future-oriented enough to say, wow, like, you know, I could do something that feels good now, but it's not going to feel good later. I'd rather have things not feel so good now so that they do feel good later. You know what I mean? Okay? A girl obviously has to be a little bit future-oriented to be able to do this. If you have a daughter who's really living in the present and really just out for pleasure now, which is basically what most boys at this age, unfortunately, a lot of them are about. Girls are a little bit more future-oriented, I found. I found that my talk on Negi is a complete waste of time for anyone less than 12th grade for boys. 9th grade, 8th grade, I can even talk to girls about it. Maybe a real mature 11th grader, okay, but that's about it. Okay, but girls do have a sense of being able to delay gratification now for the sake of something greater in the future. And we have to encourage this because this is a basic life skill. It's not just about being Shomer Negiah, it's about anything. It could be about dieting, it could be about studying for a test as opposed to going out to a party tonight, you know. It could be anything. There's so many things in life, okay, neither, you know, that require not doing something now that's pleasurable for the sake of something more important and more significant in the future. Sacrificing so your husband can study Torah, or so that you can stay home with your kids and you have, you know, happy, well-adjusted kids because you chose to live in a lower standard of living and be a more present mother. You know, there's a million things in life that call for sacrifice of momentary pleasure for the sake of a greater purpose. And this is just one of them. And I think this is a very important value to instill in our children. Okay, so just to sum up what I say on relationships, the point that I'm trying to get across to them is just that we want to be real and we want to look for the real thing. And the two ideas of being tsunua and dating appropriately and being Shomer Negiah, all those ideas, really work very much together. Okay, because a girl who has the self-respect to know who she is and know what her quality and value are is a girl who is more likely to be able to stick to her values when it comes to being Shomer Negiah, and not say, like one girl said to me, I'd really like to be Shomer Negiah, but I'm afraid my boyfriend will break up with me. Okay? I want to empower girls to believe in themselves. I want them to know what they're worth, and I want them to know that if a guy ever, ever pulls stick like that, that you say to him, well, in that case, it's been nice knowing you. You know what I mean? A lot of girls don't have that. They don't have that belief in themselves. And they get manipulated. Okay? I want a girl to be able to identify like this, a guy who's interested in her for her, as opposed to a guy who's interested in her for something less than her. Okay? So a girl has to know who she is, and she has to know how conducting herself a certain way will make it more likely that she'll get the kind of relationship she ultimately wants. I could talk on and on about this, but I don't want to, I know it will probably get a little bit late and you might have some questions. Anybody have any questions? Any comments?
Yeah, I'm just going off of what you just finished with. How do you develop that strong sense of self so that empowers somebody to feel connected? And if they're not looking for the... Everybody wants affection, acknowledgement, and that. So, you know, we're asking them to hold off in a society that all around is sending a different message.
Right.
No matter where you are, actually.
Right. The main thing, and this can be hard, sometimes even in large families it's even harder, is to make sure she's getting a lot of affection and attention and appreciation at home for who she is. Okay, I know of a girl, a Beis Yaakov girl, who has gotten involved with a boy, probably on a fairly tame level, but it doesn't seem to be strictly hands-off relationship. And it turns out that when she had a discussion with this with her mother, she let it be known that she feels that for some time now she has not been getting the love and appreciation that she needs, and she's obviously been seeking it somewhere else. Because she's like the not squeaky wheel who doesn't get the grease. So you have to make sure that all your kids, whether they're asking for it, that you give them a lot of it, and then in doing so, you praise them beneath the surface, is what I call it. Okay, it's very fine to praise a kid for getting good grades. It's a good accomplishment. Praise him for being a nice dancer, a nice musician, whatever. Your biggest praise should come for qualities of character and integrity. You should praise a kid more for when there's two pieces of cake left in the fridge, as I told the girls today. Praise a kid more for taking the little piece of cake and giving the big piece of cake to his little brother than for bringing home a straight A report card. And whenever you see anything that indicates that your child is being looked at in a spiritual light, did you want me to stop or something? Okay? You should make sure you bring that out so the child can see it. My 13-year-old came home from the park a few months ago having made a new friend, and she was very excited, and she said, Mommy, Ima, this girl told me something so nice. This girl was looking at me. I saw her looking at me and looking at me, and she finally said to me, there's something about you that's so pretty. So I said to my daughter, well, did she say you had, you know, really pretty eyes, which I think she does? She said, no. I said, did she say, you know, you have a really cute nose or, you know, really cute cheeks or pretty lips or something? No. I said, well, you know what? If she said there's something about you that seems so pretty, I think she was feeling something deeper. I think she was sensing your neshama. And she glowed when she heard that. You hear what I'm saying? So the way to praise somebody is always to connect it into that deeper stuff. When a kid's very little, you can say things like, you look so pretty today. It must be because of all the mitzvahs you've done. You know? And as they get older, when they look really pretty, compliment them. A girl likes to know that she's pretty. It's important. We live in a real world, you know? But you can say, you look so pretty. How appropriate that you should look this way when your inside is just so beautiful. Your outside matches your inside. You know what I mean? Always connect it to something deeper. Okay? Make sure you praise somebody in that way as much as possible. I have a boy, he was our challenging teenager. I hope he's the last, but I have a feeling that he's not. Okay, but he went a little bit far afield in his early and middle teenage years. And now he's solidly back, thank God. And I always knew he would be. But to this day, I can see how much he still eats up the appreciation, the deep level for who he is, because he wasn't dressing right and he wasn't acting right. And if we had been the kind of parents, and believe me, we made plenty of mistakes. I'm not trying to be self-aggrandizing at all. We made every mistake in the book. But the one mistake we didn't make is that we always made this kid feel that he's a beautiful boy, despite everything. And even today, he's 21 now, and he's religious again, and he's dating a nice girl, and thank God, you know what I mean? Okay, doesn't wear black and white, but that's not the issue, you know? I was never into that anyway. That's just the Israeli, whatever. Okay. Anyway, but you know, I said to him the other day, I was talking to him, and I pointed something out to him, and we had a great conversation in which I felt like he really heard what I was saying. I just gave him a hug, and I said, you know, you're just so beautiful. I said, I just want you to know, I've been always knowing that I was going to get such nachas from you, and I just feel this nachas so much. You know, I'm expecting really great things out of you because you're just such a beautiful, precious boy, you know? And he's still, at age 21, he still eats this up. He still needs it. He still needs it from me. And this is what is really helping him feel good about himself and helps him feel good about himself through all of his rough period, though, even though his self-esteem was very low. Because, you know, in certain circles, like, he wasn't a learner. So if, you know, you're either a learner or a loser, you know what I mean? So he got the loser label. So his self-esteem plummeted, and he was getting self-esteem through very unhealthy ways instead. And you can't turn your attention towards religion until you've got your self-esteem issues worked out, you know what I mean? So anyway, but all through that, what the thread that kept him hanging on was still feeling that his parents believed in him. You know what I mean? Even if by society standards he was a loser, which is just plain old sick, but that's just the way it is, you know? But he just knew that. You know? And there's no greater gift that you can give a kid. You can literally save a kid's life with this kind of stuff. Okay? So that's basically what I want to talk about. any other questions or anything? Or comments?
I have a comment.
Yes.
And maybe Nancy can come back and ask it. Actually, I don't know your name.
Lori.
Lori had asked, you know, how do you establish self-esteem in your teenage birth? And the first thought that popped onto my head was, especially with the teenage girls, that I think that it's important to make sure that they expect respect from the other teenage girls. And not only from, because you can't expect, you know, that's their milieu. And then they're going to go into the, you know, expecting respect from the teenage boys. So I think it goes from the family to the social content to the male-female relationship. You know, and a lot goes on in, you know, as you know, in fourth, fifth grade, junior high school, in terms of what they should expect out of a relationship.
Right.
On a girl-to-girl basis.
They should be able to identify if a girlfriend, a female friend, likes them for the right reasons
Correct.
And treats them for the right reasons
Instead
and
of
respects who they are.
The, you know,
exactly.
The whole dress thing.
You know, you dress right or you don't dress right.
Right.
You could be a friend of mine if you wear this kind of skirt, but not if you wear that kind of, you know. So they should be able to identify that as being superficial and choose their friends, hopefully based upon deeper criteria. And then again, once you've had experience with that, so to speak, you can transfer that same skill, so to speak, about, you know, being seen and appreciated for who you are into the male-female realm. I think that's a really, really good point. But I really feel that in our society, I feel like parents are like their kids' lifeline. I don't see anything out there that's really supportive of a child developing solid internal self-esteem. On the contrary, I see a world that's completely profit-oriented, that recognizes that if you can take our little girl and you can make her define herself superficially, and then you can instill insecurity about her looks, then you can sell her a million products and make money off of her to alleviate her anxiety. But there's nothing out there that stands to benefit or profit by our girls having self-esteem. Nothing. And so I just feel like we're like our children's last line of defense, if you know what I mean. And it's frightening to me. It's an overwhelming responsibility. Yeah, the schools will try and do it and everything. But, you know, you've got the schools here and you've got the billboards over here, you know. I mean, you don't have it so much in Jerusalem. This is not as hard an issue in Jerusalem, but everything's... It's just a matter of time, I almost feel like. Everything kind of just goes down, you know what I mean? Maybe I'm cynical or pessimistic. But I'll tell you a story that happened with a woman that I know. She had a six-year-old daughter. We were talking about her daughters, and she mentioned that her six-year-old daughter, she's not religious, this woman, six-year-old daughter is a cheerleader. Now, Okay, I'm ancient, okay, maybe, but like, you know, in my day, you know, way back in the Middle Ages, you know, girls were cheerleaders in like junior high and high school. I never heard of a 6-year-old doing cheerleading. I just never heard of it. So I said to her, like, who is she cheerleading for? You know? And she said to me, the 4th grade football players. I was shocked. I was 100% serious. So I said to this woman, okay, she's a woman who lives in Baltimore. I said to this woman, okay, you're not an Orthodox Jew, okay? She is Jewish, but she's not religious. I said, don't you have enough feminist sensibilities in you to like object to your little daughter being objectified and turned into a little sex object with a short skirt and everything at age 6? So she said to me, well, to tell you the truth, it bothered me, but she really wanted to be a cheerleader, and I didn't feel like fighting her on it. Okay, we could disagree with that approach, but okay. But she said, but I did put my foot down when my daughter came home with a cheer that included the words, shake your thing. This is a 6-year-old, remember. Shake your thing at age 6? She said, at that point, I feel like, you know, sorry if I sound really old-fashioned here, but like this is like, you know. So she said, at this point, she said, I went to the coach and I said to her, excuse me, I don't want my little girl knowing that she has a thing. And I certainly don't want her shaking it. Okay? So the coach removed that cheer from the roster of cheers, to her credit. Probably grudgingly, but to her credit. And this is a sad thing. Within the week, 5 women came, other mothers of cheerleaders, came over to this woman and said, thank you for saying something. Thank you for speaking up. We wanted to, but we were afraid to be looked at as prudes. And when I heard this story, I thought to myself, like, what chance do our daughters have if their mothers are afraid to defend their personhood because, God forbid, they should be looked at as a prude? Look at me as a prude, ladies, you know what I mean? Like, well, I don't care, you know? But, like, this is my daughter, and she's not going to dance around in a short little skirt cheering on the boys at age 6. I'm sorry. And hopefully not at any age, but certainly not while I have any authority over her. You know what I mean? And, like, we are our daughter's last line of defense here. Who else is looking out for them? Sure, you know, you have the schools and you have whatever, but, like, you know, in terms of society at large, nobody, you know, nobody cares, you know? So if they don't get it from us and they don't get it from the home, you're like, you're setting them adrift in a kind of like, you know, what Mary Pfeiffer called, I think, in The Shelter of Our Families, whatever it was, a shelter from the storm, whatever it was. You know Mary Pfeiffer, who wrote the book Reviving Ophelia? So she wrote another book called In the Shelter of Each Other, that's what it was called, about families. She said, what did she say again? Basically, the home has to provide all of this stuff. It's not going to come from anywhere else. Where are our kids' lifelines? Yeah.
What do you think was the quality in Ibsen Kramer? Do you think that enabled her to come out with a song?
Yeah.
That enabled her to know to do it.
I think that she was just raised, obviously, with a very deep sense of religiosity. And the reports go that as a young child, she was already very special in certain ways. But I didn't read about her saying that she was special and that she knew this so much. Somehow in her life, she was able just to see through the veils that cloud our thinking and just get to the essence of something that's important and just identify that and say, just, you know. I don't know if I have... there's other things a lot that Sarah wrote about her. Amazing things about being able to put her own will aside for the sake of a peaceful relationship with her husband, who is also a tzaddik in his own right. About her incredible selflessness, other-oriented givingness. I don't recall in the book that and she traces the development of some of those traits, and they didn't always come easy to her. She had a struggle for some of them. I don't recall in the book. I'll have to reread it for a third or fourth time already. I've read it actually 3 times at least. But I don't recall her saying where she got this ability just to discern reality so clearly. That the reality of me is that I'm a soul, and that where my soul can best express itself is the best place for me to be, even if that means Auschwitz. That an active soul in Auschwitz is better than a dormant soul in America. You know what I mean? It wasn't clear to me where she got that quality from. But if you look deeply enough at the world, and like what you're here for, you can kind of deduce that. You know what I mean? I mean, if we're here to grow, and if we're here to shine more light in the world, and if we're here to do good, then by definition, a circumstance in life that allows me to do those things is an ideal circumstance, even though it might not be physically pleasant. You know what I'm saying? If that's really our self-definition. If our purpose is to have a comfortable existence, then, you know, then being able to do mitzvahs in Auschwitz is not positive.
She was definitely gifted the way she cursed
this boy,
right.
And he ended up shooting himself. Yeah.
She knew she had that.
She had that power, but that's a different power. The power to, and the father said to her, "If you have the power to curse, you have the power to bless." And then she ended up being able to give all these blessings to people. But that's a different thing than knowing who you are. She's eight. She's eight. But that's a different power than knowing who you are.
Right.
I think it's just a power of just being in touch with truth. I'm not sure where it comes from.
Teenager. See, what I'm trying to get from it, you know, as having lived a long time now, you know, you learn a lot over the years.
Yeah.
You're sitting there with a teenager. And you go through all this stuff like you talked about. It was very beautiful. But I'm always looking for, like, what's that little thing to help them do that? The word.
I think the best thing is just showing them what you're focused on and what you value. And when you come home and you share stories of something that was so beautiful that moved you so much today, about how just a girl could smile at somebody and cheer them up and make them feel better about life. And how that's so significant. Like, I think the little things get overlooked so easily. You know what I mean? We focus on things that are more easily identifiable. You know, you got first prize in this, or you excelled in this, you did that, whatever. It's those little things. Like, I remember one time with my 13-year-old, when she was very younger, she had a problem with taking things that didn't belong to her. Okay? So I encouraged her to tell me every time she overcame that tendency. Like, I want to hear about it. Come tell me. So I remember she'd come to me and say, "Ema, I want you to know that there was a 5-shekel coin on the counter today, and I looked at it and I thought I want to take it and go to the grocery store and buy myself a treat, but I didn't take it." And I just praised her profusely for that, for overcoming a drive to do something wrong and choosing to do something right. That's empowering a child. You know, so to me, and I can't claim it's so much easier to talk about than do it. I'm not as vigilant as a mother as I should be. I'm not always tuned in to all these things because my head is scattered and I'm going in different directions and thinking things and I have failed at times in this area. So if it's easy to tell other people about it, then always do it yourself. But I can tell you that I've learned to experience that vigilance for small things. The kids always, they do small things for one another, and we take it for granted, just a little thing. Like, we just take so many little things for granted. And that's what one of my daughters said to me once. She said to me, you know what she did actually? She bought a magnet on the refrigerator, which I thought she was buying for me. And it turned out she was buying it for her. And the magnet says, nobody, what is it? Nobody sees what I do around here until I don't do it. And I thought, I said to her, "Thank you for getting this from me." I said, "How did you know this is exactly how I feel?" And she said to me, "What are you talking about?" She said, "I got it for myself. This is how I feel." And like, this is a kid who does so many nice things. She'll like do the dishes for me Friday night and clean up and do this, you know, and like, you remember to thank her the first couple times, and you begin taking it for granted. You know, my daughter, just taking things for granted, I think, is like the biggest enemy of so many things in life, but also of building a kid's self-esteem. Every little thing that they do, just notice. When a kid comes in the house, and instead of leaving their rollerblades in the middle of the floor, they push them under the table, you know? Say, you know, "Wow, you know, thank you. Someone could have tripped on him and you cared that nobody would trip on him. You pushed him on the table." Little things, you know, and again, I don't excel in this. I'm talking to remind myself as much as I am to tell you. But these are the things that build a child's self-esteem. They're small, little building blocks, little incremental observations that you make about a child that points out to them things that they might not have even seen in themselves. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I notice this thing about you, and then a kid can say, "Hey, you know, my mom's right. I did do this. Hey, you know, And that's how it slowly gets built. Yeah.
When you talk about your son who kind of
went off. Yeah.
And came back. What do you attribute to what you like? What did you do besides what you're saying now and that what you did?
I'll tell you what we did right amidst all the things we did wrong. The thing we did right, the thing that our trump card was our relationship with him. And there's a big child rearing expert in Jerusalem, Mrs. Spetner, who's very, very well known and very respected there. Okay, and she emphasizes over and over again that when you have a kid as a teenager, your authority is basically gone. They're going to do what they want to do. You can tell them what to wear; they'll change at the mall. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like you don't know where they are and with whom, and you can't. Mm-hmm. So you have to switch from authority mode to influence mode, and you have to focus all your attentions not on discipline, not on making rules, but on building your relationship with this child, because that is the only thing that you have in your power at that point. So the one thing that we did right with this particular teenager, I think we were too permissive at times, I think we made a lot of mistakes, but the one thing that we did right, and it served us in the end, was that this kid always felt that we loved him, and he loved us, and he wasn't rebelling against us. We weren't putting the ropes down on him and pulling him in and saying, you can't do this, and if you can, you're going to be locked out, and you have to have the rules, and da-da-da. Maybe we gave him too much freedom, but we gave him a lot of love and support. And even through the worst of it, he sent up at a party and made a public declaration that he thinks his parents are the greatest. You know? So my husband immediately went to, sure, he thinks we're great. We never tell him he can't do anything he wants to do. What kid wouldn't think is going to stay up till 4 in the morning? Sure, we love you. You're great parents. You know what I mean? But still, you know, and then when he went to the army, he bought us this picture, and on the matting around the picture, he wrote a message, and he said, I never told you this, but I admire you and look up to you in a lot of ways, you know? And thank you for supporting me, but in the army, it makes me go with a good feeling. And then he sent me an email message, he sent me a text message on my cell phone once that said, I thank God every day for having parents like you. Yeah, like, you know, this is the kind of stuff that really can make me cry and really make me think, you know, maybe I'm redeemable after all, you know, like all the mistakes. But still, I it sounds so corny, but I just, you see the power of love. You can make all these mistakes with a kid in terms of too much discipline, too little discipline, too this, too that, giving them too much rope, not giving them enough, a million mistakes, and the kid knows that he's loved. It's just like, it's like a magic potion, you know? And he came back, and I want to tell you something else that gives you chizuk, is that when your kids are being really problematic, if you have put good stuff into them at younger ages, it's in there. It's in there. It might not be showing, but it's in there. And I always tell the story because it's so telling. When my son was at his worst, he was 16 years old, he was wearing like shirts like cut off like this and pants halfway down his tush, and like, ugh, I couldn't stand looking at him. And then he cut his hair really short. I said, you look like a thug. I just like, ugh. You know what I mean? At his worst stage of his life, okay? I don't know what he was doing. I don't want to know, you know? I heard him on the phone. He was like 16 years old, and I heard him on the phone to another boy, and they were talking about some girl that this boy was interested in, right? And I heard my son say to this boy, but what do you think she really likes you for? Your outside or your inside? You know what I'm saying? It was there. Do you know what I'm saying? It was there. It didn't surface in the way he was dressing at that moment. Because he was dressing like an outside. But the consciousness was there, and when it resurfaced, it's resurfaced so strong and so beautifully. He's such a beautiful neshama, this boy. Yeah.
What you're saying, it sounds so beautiful, like just keep loving them.
It doesn't only take loving. You need more than love, but I'm saying that this is the most important thing not to blow it on. That's all I'm trying to say.
Right, because we do live in scary times where they make choices that can really affect their lives.
I know.
They go down one wrong turn, that's it. Future's gone, you know.
I know.
Like, that's where, like, because you say kind of got to put the discipline out a little bit. How do you do that when you know that they can, like, your son, thank God, he came out of it, but I'm sure there's a number of them that went down the path, and then that was it. Their future was
Well, his future his future has definitely changed. He's not going to be able to marry the kind of girl that he could have married before now that
but
he has a past.
Tina's compared to some of the stuff maybe, you know, does happen.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, he was never into hard drugs and he was never promiscuous
right.
and things like that.
Stuff.
Yeah,
that's
thank
fine.
God.
There's a lot of some kids that do go down that
right.
go off the Derek and go down that path.
But when they really go really far down the path, and especially the drug issues, the kids I know, and my son has had a friend who died a drug-related death, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently drug-related. We'll never know for sure, okay? But I'm just saying that these kids are kids who there was deeper issues going on at home. It wasn't just following their tithes. It's not that. When a kid gets into hard drugs and promiscuity and stuff like that, there's something more going on, okay? My son did whatever he did and because he wanted to have fun. He wasn't rebelling. He wanted to have fun.
Shouldn't we be directing them? I guess, I mean, I have younger kids, so I'm not quite there yet.
Oh, you're so lucky.
Like you were saying, I have a 13-year-old, that's my
uh-huh.
oldest. But I keep thinking, could I sit back and watch them going down? I'm like, I have control. I know you're saying I don't have control, but
I guess, but
you're saying it's like your son's future kind of was affected a little bit by what...
Of course it was affected.
But you felt like there was nothing else you could do.
No, there is absolutely... I know. Well, you got to learn to let go of control. You're going to be eating yourself up at nights. At a certain point, you just have to realize your kid is going to do what they want to do. They're going to do it. And now the question is, do you want to create a really punitive, negative atmosphere in the home where they're not, where you're just going to drive them underground?
No.
Or do you want to make your... I never pretended I liked what he was doing. I made my feelings very clear. Oh, absolutely. I made my feelings very clear, and I made it clear that I know that you are going to do what you want to do. I want you to know how I feel about it, just for the record, just so you know. And it was there. Ima, do you like this shirt? No. Finished.
That thing when they look under your roof, you have to dress the way we, otherwise you, like, doesn't some of that come, like, can you do that now, still, or no?
I think you can definitely do that.
Can you do stuff like that? And
yeah, sure.
You're living under, I mean, not like,
you definitely say,
have
listen.
A leash on them, but like, have
yeah, you can say, listen, I can't control what you're going to wear when you're out with your friends, but this is a certain kind of home, we have certain standards here. When you're in this house, you can't wear this. You know, you can definitely say that. But if when you try and clamp down on them, it's just a prescription for rebellion. And when they're going to do it, like, believe me, I believe in holding on to authority to the last minute that you can. If I thought that my 16-year-old wouldn't come in, would come back home by midnight if I said he had to, and that he wouldn't do it with hateful feelings to me, I would say you have to be home by midnight. You know what I'm saying? But once it becomes clear that if I say you have to be home by midnight and he's not going to be home by midnight anyway, then there's no point anymore. All it does is creates distance and antagonism. It serves no positive purpose. Do you know what I'm saying? No. I am not writing a book on parenting until I see all my kids come through in the water. Because I'm not qualified yet. I'm just sharing with you what I have learned. I am not an expert. I am not qualified to write a book on this yet. When I see that they're all out of the woods, I'll write my book. But in the meantime, the other books I think I could be very, very helpful. I'm not just trying to sell my books. I really think they could be very helpful. There's a chapter in Head to Heart, which I think is incredibly important, and people have thanked me for this chapter. How to recognize the signs of an abusive personality when you're dating. Like, before you marry the guy. The Shalom Task Force in New York was going to, like, buy several hundred copies of the book. They didn't end up doing it in the end, maybe because there might be other stuff in the book that perhaps they didn't agree with, whatever it was. But I've been considering, like, maybe just printing that up separately and making it available for distribution through, like, domestic violence things. Oh, here? Okay. Okay, great.
What were the main signs?
I mean, I have a list of about 14 of them and everything like that. You know, from controllingness that's, you know, seems very flattering because he wants to know where you are all the time and have your cell phone on all the time and be available and, you know, not spend time with anybody but me and all that. That's the main thing. But there's a whole bunch of stuff. But I also talk about, you know, the emotional maturity necessary for dating. It's not about parenting. Like I said, that the parenting book is brewing. You know what I mean? But you have to make sure you're saying something that people haven't said already. There's a million books out on parenting.
Yeah, I like when people like you write parenting books, though, because you've experienced
Yeah.
A lot,
like the struggles and
that.
You know, it's not just all this, you know,
yeah. Real stuff. Yeah, we have more stuff coming up now. So I'm like, you know, you think this is going to be the one kid, and the other one's just going to be clear sailing, and then all of a sudden you just start discovering stuff about your 15-year-old that you never knew before, and you're like, oh no, not again, no, you know, whatever. I mean, no, it's not that, but you know, still, there's always issues. You know, you're very, very blessed if you get through life having no challenging teenagers. You're just very blessed, you know. And kids will have their own natures. Maybe the last thing I can just say about this is, like, I think there's a tremendous tendency for parents to blame themselves for all of their children's shortcomings. Yes, I did make mistakes raising my son, and they did affect him, and they did play into him making choices that he made and things like that. But I'm not responsible for his nature. And some kids just have a nature where they have strong physical desires. They're totally live in the moment, pleasure-seeking type kids. Other kids are just more serious, they're more sheltered, they're more naive, they're more studious, they're more this, they're more that. Like, I think parents can't take more upon themselves, you know, than they're really responsible for. That's one thing I learned. That was very liberating. It's like, yeah, I messed up in certain ways, but I am not responsible for all this kid's behavior. I'm really not. Like, this is his nature also. It's his teva, you know. Yeah.
If I may ask you, what would be the number one mistake maybe you think you did that one should avoid?
Okay, I can tell you, but I think it's really only relevant to life in Israel, but I don't mind telling you if you want to hear it. Okay, one of the biggest problems that Americans have in Israel is that we don't fit in. Okay, some people do. The Israeli Haredi community is extremely circumscribed. And you have to look a certain way, talk a certain way, read certain things, don't read other things, dress a certain way, and all this kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? And we Americans don't fit in right. But we try and put our children into that school system because we still think it's the best possible school system for them, but we don't really fit the mold. So our children grow up with a very confused message. I'm being sent to the school, but my mother doesn't dress this way. And I'm going to the school, but my father doesn't think this way. And I made the very, very big mistake of actually speaking negatively about my children's schools or about the society that they lived in out of my own frustrations in front of my children when they were growing up. Enormous, enormous mistake. Now, that could also be true here in America, although not to...
It's the same thing?
Okay, it can't be as bad just because things aren't... Although I hear that the Fairfax community is pretty, you know... Okay, so the most important thing that you can do, one of them, is to be consistent. When you decide to send a kid to a school, keep your mouth shut if you don't like something in that school. And I've learned that in my later years. My daughter came home from school repeating a comment that one of her substitute teachers made, where a girl said the word dinosaur in class, and this teacher said, dinosaurs are a goyish invention, and they never were, and da-da-da-da, and it's a sore to say the word dinosaur, she said. Okay? So, in the past, I would have said something very not complimentary about the teacher. So this time, I just chose to say, I said, well, you know, there is such a hashkafa that there weren't dinosaurs and whatever, and there are some people who believe that, so we have to respect it. On the other hand, there seem to be religious scientists who think that there might very well have been dinosaurs. I believe that Rambam actually, some people talk about the fact that there could have been, you know, bigger creatures that once lived and whatever. I said, but there are many perspectives, and they all have to be respected. And I went to my room and went, you know, hey! But I just shut up. Like, for me, I have a very big mouth. That's half the reason why I like lecturing and why I write books. I don't have a big enough mouth, so I have to write books. That my big mouth can't reach. But I just have to, like, shut my big mouth. That's the best piece of advice I could give a mother. Shut your big mouth. Seriously. I'm sorry to say it. But, like, honestly and truly. You know what I mean?
So when, back to her conversation with you, regarding how sometimes you handle your son.
Yeah.
So when you know he's not coming back at 12, so
right.
You just don't say anything?
No, I don't. One time I stayed up, I couldn't sleep, I was worried about him, I didn't know where he was, I was a little upset, I was up at the computer, and he walked into the house, and I just looked up at him from the computer like this, with pain in my eyes. And he looked back at me, and he came in, and he said, I'm really sorry. I don't want you to be worried, but I just am hanging out with friends. I was having a good time. Like he knew that I didn't have to say, you know, where were you? You whatever. I just said it with my eyes. I was worried about you. I can't sleep. I couldn't sleep because of you. You know what I'm saying? And he understood. And he wasn't. See, the thing with him, and this thing is, he wasn't rebelling against us, and he wasn't rebelling against Judaism. He just wanted to have fun. This is a kid who wanted to have fun. More fun than you can have being a Haredi boy in Jerusalem. I mean, how many 14-year-old boys, if they thought about too much, would want to be Haredi at that age? You know what I'm saying? You know, like, okay? Like, you know. So he wanted to have fun, and he knew that we loved him, and we knew that we cared about him, and the fact that he could feel that I was worried and it pained me was more significant than if I punished him or scolded him or something like that. It was the relationship. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. What about when your daughter wears something that you don't really have to
wear? Yeah, she has.
It's like she kissed
me. Yeah, well, we don't have quite that, but there's other things. No, no. So again, when you can tell the girl you can't wear that, you do. But when it gets past the point at which you can't say that anymore...
What is the point? What is
it? It's different for every girl. It's usually around 14 or so, but it's different for different girls. We have one who's starting at 13. We have another one who I thought I could go till 15 with, and I wasn't quite so right, but whatever. But whatever age it is, at that point, you have to let your feelings be known in no uncertain terms and just accept the fact that she's going to wear what she wants to wear. And you can say, you know, in the house there are certain standards, whatever. You know what I mean? I don't really like doing that so much, to tell you the truth, unless I feel it's going to impact negatively on the other kids, because I want to see what she's wearing. Like if I say you can't wear that in the house, then I don't know what she's changing into in the restroom at the mall or whatever it is. I'd rather have a clearer picture of what's going on with this kid. You know what I mean? Anyway, my daughter does not wear anything that's so terrible that she can't wear it in the house. It's just, it's on the border of stuff that I don't think is, you know. So I will just say things to her, you know. It's so lo matim lach, I'll say in Hebrew, you know. It's not the way you're a quality girl. And this is just not the way a quality girl looks. It's chaval. It's a betraying of yourself. You know what I'm saying? So you're building up the girl at the same point that you're putting down her dress. You shouldn't be dressing this way because you're too good for this. You know what I'm saying? That's the message you want to get to them. Okay? I think it's probably gotten quite late. We should probably let you guys get home to your families. And thank you very much. My books are available over there. Okay, if anyone's interested.
So the price
Oh, they're about 25% off the store price. $3 off the store price. They're $10 for the thinner book, The Magic Touch, which is about being Shomer Negiah, because it's a book that made me famous or infamous, depending upon if you're a boy or a girl. And Head to Heart is $12. Okay, thank you.